Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma-informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
Welcome to the Trauma-Informed Lens podcast. Today, our title is The Two Whys, Explaining How We Think About Behavior. So we're excited to get in this topic, really building a lot about what we've already talked about with trauma, homeostasis, epigenetics, intergenerational trauma. For our sixth episode, we have dug ourselves a deep hole into the trauma-informed paradigm already. So I'm excited to get into the behavioral aspects of this, because it's really so much of what I have learned through my research on trauma explains the why behind behaviors. And one of the powers, I think, of the paradigm is when we understand the why behind some of the behaviors, it builds our empathy and compassion for people that might be struggling with trauma and some of these behavioral issues that we're trying to help them out with. So as always, we start out with the bright, shiny objects of the week. So something as three people that are borderline obsessed, at least nerds around this topic, just things that we're thinking about this week. So Kurt, I'll let you start us out. What's your bright, shiny object of the week this week?
I had some really fun opportunities this week to meet with former colleagues of mine and hear about some of the work that they're doing in the various different environments that they're in. And they're really working a lot in developing trauma-informed approaches with a variety of populations. And that was really fun for me to hear about their experiences with new organizations and with new populations, and really seeing how they are applying this information in a variety of settings was really enjoyable. I had some real fun conversations this week with that. It was great.
Excellent. It's fun to see how this just sort of morphs and transforms in a lot of really cool ways. So very cool. Jerry, my friend, what about you? What are you thinking about this week?
Well, I happened to come across an article. I actually just sent it out on Facebook. But since 2007, the number of children being sent to adult prisons and tried as adults has dropped significantly. And I think that some of the advocacy that has gone on around that has really begun to show some good results in our awareness of the science that the brain doesn't stop changing until people are in the late 20s is really, I think, one of the impetus, some of the issues we're talking about on this podcast. So what I hope is that the advocacy doesn't stop, and that we begin to think about how do we intervene in these children's life before they commit the crimes, not after they commit the crime. So I'm really excited about some of the positive findings and the stats coming out, but also motivated to keep up pushing and disseminating this work.
Very cool. And I know you've been a leader in this, in our state and beyond. So
I've been involved.
You're a leader in my book, at least. It's great to get, I think, in a time where we don't get a lot of great criminal justice news sometimes coming out, it's nice to hear some good trends on that piece. So very cool. Well, my bright, shiny object of this week had to do with a honor I had on Monday. I gave the keynote address for the Jefferson County Public Library Conference. For those of you not from the Colorado area, Jefferson County is a really large county west of Denver. And so one of the things that if you would ask me when Jerry hired me and introduced me to this whole thing, would I be training library staff on what it meant to be a trauma-informed library, I would have probably just laughed at you. But it's one of the things that I've had the opportunity to do this with a handful of libraries. And also a lot of times when I go into communities now, I encourage the community that's organizing the training to make sure you invite the libraries as well. I miss this in my thinking, but for so many people that don't have a safe place to go, that they may be experiencing homelessness or home's not a safe place. I remember when I worked in child welfare residential, for sometimes when our kids needed a break and might have left the facility unannounced sometimes, then we would find them in the library for the most part. I know folks that are experiencing homelessness. A lot of times that's the one warm or cool safe place that they can go. And I just find that library staff are just some of the most, that they're so dedicated to creating a welcoming space for everybody in their community. And so they're really interested in learning more about folks that are coming in that they've kind of struggled with some of the mental health issues, addiction issues, but there's just this really dedication to helping folks out. And I love the energy of these conferences. I'll tell you just a little quick, as people who present, you'll appreciate this. So of course at libraries, they got to have a theme. So it was 70s. And so they were playing all these 70s music, which I was born in 74, but I had a classic rock phase in high school. So 70s music was big in my formative years. And right before I presented, they played Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. And I was, part of my talk is how memories sort of remind us and take us back to certain times and places. And no time in the past have I ever heard Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On before presenting in front of anybody. So I had a whole lot of different chemical emotions going on in my body. And the sound guy was great. So after I stopped my talk, he started to play it again. And so we sort of had a little Marvin Gaye dance party, if you can imagine. 6'7" me doing my sexiest dance moves in front of 300 plus people. So it was a great time with the folks in Jefferson County. So remember the library, folks.
Really appreciate that mental imagery, Matt. That's great.
It was, and I've scarred everybody. So I may not be allowed to cross the county line, which is bad because it's right about two streets over from my house. So I might be banned in there, NC-17 at my training. Kurt, I'm going to switch it over to you today to let you really introduce our topic. We're hitting that behavioral piece of things. So hand it off to you, and looking forward to see where we go today.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about how to talk about this topic, and I love to have an example to go from. And I really, thinking back on how some of this thinking got developed, it really was discussions between Jerry, me, and a small group of leaders and clinicians at a residential treatment facility, where we were all working and developing training materials for how to train our entire staff in thinking in the trauma-informed lens. As you think, I take it all the way back. I mean, really the issue is, as we think about the difference between various approaches and a behavioral approach being one of them, and what it does and what the difference is in becoming trauma-informed or trauma-sensitive, is that answering the question of why a behavior happened or what caused a behavior becomes a much more complicated question. It really integrates ideas and helps us to answer that question at different levels. So it's not that we replace any other idea or essentially get rid of any idea, it's that we integrate them better. And so as we had discussions about that, Jerry can tell the story as well as I can, that I think we had to argue about every slide that we went through in order to integrate our ideas and develop some common language about that. When he said a word, was I thinking the same thing that he was thinking when he said that word? And most of the time, that was not true. We had to talk through every single point so that we had a shared language and a shared mental model of what we were talking about. And I think what came out of it was a really nice way to blend these two approaches that oftentimes in my just clinical practical experience become at odds with each other. So I thought about how to kind of present these ideas. And the idea is that there are multiple whys or multiple levels of answering the question, why does a behavior happen? And so, but basically those are just to kind of describe them, that what we know is that early childhood experience causes changes in many areas that are important to our functioning later in life. And one of them is our developmental trajectory. So when we go through experiences early in our childhood, it changes how we develop. It changes how our brain develops. And that can result in changes downstream much later in life. Mm-hmm. One of those changes is it changes how we form relationships with other people. In clinical words, we call that attachment. So that's one of the major areas that it causes some changes, how we think about people and how we experience people in our lives. Another major area that it changes is that it changes how our nervous system reacts to the environment. It sensitizes it. And so sensitization, great, I like to define that word for people often. And that means that you have a larger than normal response to normal level stimulation or normal level events. So our nervous system then adjusts to experiences that we have as childhood. And epigenetics was one way that we talked about that, that experiences then can change sensitivities to other events or other chemicals within our body and outside of our body. And then one of the other changes that starts to happen when all of those things come together is that the way that we access and use memories changes. And one important impact of that is that different components of experience don't get coordinated together. So there may be a sensory motor component of an experience that gets untied from a cognitive component or from an emotional component. So the way that we then use memories gets changed. So that's a way of talking about one why. And the other way of thinking about it is what's going on currently. And this is where we often get into some kind of a disagreement between a trauma-informed approach and a quote-unquote behavioral approach, is that we're looking at more at different timing of different variables. So the typical behavioral approach is much more focused in on what's going on in the current environment. And you may back up a little bit in time from the behavior that you're describing, but we don't often go very far back from that because we're really trying. And that's not the goal of the behavioral approach. The goal is to look at environment behavior relationships and use them to help to understand behavior in its current environment. What's the function of it, or what's the usefulness of it? And how do we then design our environments to support changes? So something that happens with trauma is that people who have undergone traumatic experiences almost always have to develop extreme coping strategies for those. And our biology is designed that way. And that's one of the I think the great areas of talking about evolution, that our biology may not have caught up to our world yet, that our stress response is really designed for an environment in which we needed rapid, violent action in order to survive. And that's not so much the case anymore, but we still have that response. So these extreme coping strategies get developed to deal with really challenging situations. And then what happens is that we have an environment and we have a mechanism that the environment uses, which we call contingencies. And that is a method of constraining and selecting certain behaviors to be repeated if they're useful for us and they help us to adapt. Then the environment then interacts on us as a being, as an organism, to select certain behaviors for being repeated and useful for us in our immediate adaption, our immediate environment. And then one aspect of behavior that is really kind of is an important one to think about here is this idea called, in the behavioral parlance, we call it the avoidance paradox. And to describe that kind of succinctly, that is that in the behavioral world, in our language, in the way we talk about behavior, we're always talking about physical events. And so I look at what happened before a behavior, then I look at the behavior, and then I look at what happened after it. And those three things are the building blocks then of my explanatory framework. But what happens with avoidance is that when I engage in some behavior, the thing that happens after it is nothing. So it causes a problem for us explaining what maintains this behavior because nothing followed it. It's like the actual absence of an event that maintains it. Hmm. And that can then keep these extreme coping strategies going for a long period of time, because we never essentially find out that we don't need them anymore. We're continuing to engage in them to avoid what what has happened to us in the past. So for me, that was a way of integrating these two whys. And you can kind of start with one event and either work from the past into the current environment or start with the current environment, work your way to the past. Essentially, the point is to get us to a position where we can integrate our understanding and our, the levels at which we're asking and answering the question, why did this behavior occur? And that to me is the real beauty of a trauma-informed approach is that it integrates a lot of ideas and you can bring new things into it and go, let's change our understanding again and increase our integration of ideas even further. So that's kind of a nutshell of the two whys. And I thought of an example that maybe we could use to generate a little bit of discussion. It was in a football game this weekend. And I actually love football. I love watching it. And I was watching this one play. And the result of the play was really interesting in that it was really a very well-defended pass play that ended up in no gain of yards or distance for the offense. But what happened within this play was one of those things that really catches my attention. And that was that there was one player, he was a running back actually, who really sacrificed something for another one of his teammates in this play, and it caught my attention. So I think it was the Kansas City Chiefs game I was watching, and the quarterback was in the shotgun waiting for the ball. Everybody's ready for this immediate action. Everybody's going to take all these different coordinated steps as soon as the ball is hiked to the quarterback. And as soon as that ball was hiked, a player came on a free blitz from the quarterback's blind side. And this running back was standing on the other side of the quarterback. And he saw the blitz coming and he went clear across the quarterback's body, left his feet and blocked this other player, which clearly saved the quarterback from being completely annihilated and allowed the quarterback to then turn and run the other way and basically run out of bounds for no gain. Right, so you wonder, why did that running back do that? Like, why did he go through all that effort and take that big action to sacrifice something for one of his teammates that really resulted in no gain for the team? So I read about this guy. His name is Sharkhandrick West. And I started going back to what happened in the current environment, right? You could analyze that in terms of he had the training history that's what his job was on that play. And then he caught the cue that player was going to come, and he caught it early enough that he was then able to make the move to block him. And then you can go even back further then to that he had, you know, it turns out that when he was born, he was almost 10 pounds and he went through like these developmental stages. So he actually had the physical capability to make that move. So you could go all the way back to there. And then in the middle of it, you found out, as I read about him, that he had some incredible relational experiences. And one was that early in his career, it was at the point that he was learning that he was going to be really good at football. He got sick and he couldn't play. And doctors told him he would never play again. And so the value in essentially, worked his way back, and great story. And so you kind of think about all of the whys that would explain why he would do something that was in one sense so selfless to a teammate. Right, his appreciation for being able to play the game goes back to his early childhood history. His appreciation for teammates goes back to a relationship that he had with a coach and to his stepfather, who really were formative to him. And then you can take it all the way to the current environment about him detecting the right cue and having the physical capability to engage in it. So all of those things kind of were an example, I think, for me of thinking about how we can increase our understanding of the why and always be able to look at it from multiple levels. And that's the real beauty of the trauma-informed approach and the lens. So Jerry, I'm wondering from your experience, having gone through all those arguments with me over all those slides, to think about and hear those ideas coming together, I wonder what that's like for you. And certainly you're always good at asking me the questions that I haven't thought of. So some questions that you might have hearing me go through that kind of overview.
Well, first of all, you did a good job of going through the framework that we've kind of created and thought through dealing with cold. But, the thought I had is that what we know is that what is the most powerful stimuli for us as a species is the presence of an attentive, attuned other in our lives. And what we do is we try very hard to put meaning to experiences so that we can, in some ways, figure out what is an adaptive response. So we sat in a room and tried to make sense of lots of behaviors of children that didn't seem to make sense. And I think that, you know, the question really isn't what the framework you put in your head to do it. The question is how does that framework change the relationship you have to the person who you're trying to help and support? And what's that relationship that you're going to? So I think some of the conflict comes up is I know you and you do a really good job of integrating this information. But when you're dealing with individuals, you have an ability to connect with them. And I think that regardless of what frameworks we create, we can't get so attached to our frameworks and miss connecting to the person in front of us. And I think that that's the important piece of having a framework that guides us so we don't just kind of get organized by the behavior response, but we don't get so attached to our framework that we miss connecting. And I think that that's what the trauma-informed approach tries to balance out. Helps us have an understanding of what kind of experiences and why this person might be behaving they are, but also that they need a sense of connectedness, compassion, and support in order to have a new experience, in order to not necessarily engage in what worked in the past, but have something new. So I think that what I learned from, especially from you, is that people have all sorts of ways of organizing information. And really what it comes down to is, how can we connect with the people that we're been kind of challenged to serve?
I think it's especially true when we're dealing with symptoms that are really acute symptoms and things that are really challenging for us as organizations or as individuals to tolerate, that our urge then is to disengage. And that's when we need to engage the most, which is something that's been really helpful for me to have this framework. I like to intellectualize a lot of things. And so having a framework helps me to intellectualize it and helps me to stay engaged and stay curious. Which is helpful to me as a leader to help my teams stay engaged. I can use the framework to help them remain curious and stay asking questions, even when they're especially when they want to get disengaged.
Right.
How does that match up with your thinking, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, and this is sort of the larger shiny object that I'm chasing in my own professional development is to really... No, and it goes back to some of our previous podcast is especially around the concept of homeostasis and, you know, how on one hand, and I thought our podcast did a good job of kind of talking about this from both angles. And in one hand, and I think this, I believe if I'm hearing you correctly, hits kind of this first why is sort of, you know, the state sort of homeostasis in some way is that over time, because of attachment, environment, you know, epigenetics, we sort of create who we are at that moment. And then that's always something that's evolving and changing, but overall fairly consistent over time. And then there's sort of the homeostasis where something in the environment sort of knocks us out of that. And so I kind of wonder, as I'm kind of sitting here with that sort of in the forefront of my mind, you know, with my work being done outside the podcast is, how do you see our conversations around states, traits, and homeostasis play into these two questions about, okay, what's happened to you and what sort of sets of variables are going on right now that's eliciting like I think you said, extreme coping skill, which I really like, and kind of putting those pieces together. I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on that piece.
Well, one thing I think is that a way of thinking about stress and what does stress mean? If you bring this back to the ideas of homeostasis or of allostasis, mm-hmm. that a stressor is anything that pushes us away from what that hypothetical ideal point is.
Yeah.
And the idea of states becoming traits or states mm-hmm. changing is that anything that pushes us out of a state where we are comfortable is something that increases our allostatic load. And then our biology and our systems all, it's not one system, I will study them all in isolation, but they never work that way. Mm-hmm. They all put multiple mechanisms in place to bring us back.
Yeah.
So as an example, I was actually doing a case consultation yesterday, and they were talking a lot about wanting to know what was this person thinking while they were engaging in some extreme symptom. And so we started talking about how would you get some kind of idea of what's going on inside of that person's body and what their state was. And I, not surprisingly so, suggested heart rate mm-hmm. to be able to get an idea of what their state was. And so we started talking about that, and the group really quickly got to, I bet that this child's heart rate is very high. We can't see this person's heart rate in the moment without some kind of other measurement, but they could see in this child's behavior that the child appeared very anxious and was exhibiting some symptoms that we interpret as anxiety. And so we thought his internal state is hyper aroused. And so what we then had to think about is that the way that for those of us that live in a state where, let's say our internal state and our comfort zone is at an arousal level that is a heart rate of about 60 beats a minute. If we get up above 120, our urge starts to be to bring it down. Mm-hmm. We start to get feelings that we're like, this is hard. I want to bring it down, which is our systems then trying to put us back into balance. What happens when those states get changed is that this child may be living and that temporary state of being at 120 beats per minute becomes a trait mm-hmm. where that feels normal. So for this child, when the child the heart rate comes down, their urge is not to, that's not good. That's not where they feel good. So they get the urge to bring it back up. And they start engaging in behavior to bring their state back to where they feel comfortable. Yeah. And oftentimes that is symptoms or behavior that we feel like we need to manage. Mm-hmm. So getting a team to think about that, our ideas about what's regulation and what's comfortable are reversed. Mm-hmm. And that can really help a team immensely in understanding the symptoms that happen in front of them and manage them differently and understand them and interact with that person in a different way.
Let me throw out one of our biggest fans is my wife, Sarah, who's if for those that don't know, is a first grade teacher. So let me just throw, I can even see the question in her head right now. Let's say she has, we'll just say a hypothetical kid in her first grade class this year who has that higher kind of homeostatic heart rate. So they feel comfortable at that higher level. And she's, let's say, just for sake of argument, she's got two of those in a class of 25. So how do you say, so she gets the first question. She says, okay, well, these kids are going through some hard times at home. There's instability here. There's instability there. And I'm in, and I think library folks have this same issue. A lot of people, you know, when you're in sort of a residential setting, everybody might be set at that high level. But in these other settings is that you have a minority there. The majority are kind of got the average. How do you set an environment for those service providers that are in that dynamic? How do you address those two realities to create a safe and effective environment for all concerned?
And you've got limited resources too, right?
Hey, so absolutely. 1-to-25 ratio, occasionally a little bit of a para support. So
I'll tell you, if I had an easy answer to that question, I'd have a lot of money.
And I'd probably be out of a job. So I guess it's good either way. But how would you, and this is for both of you, how would you at least have her think about that reality? Because I think this is the complexity that this research gets us to very quickly. So even if there's not a solution, because you'd probably want to meet these two kids and do assessments and this, that, and the other, but how should we start to think about behaviors within the context of that?
So Matt, that's you're raising a really good question, right? So one of the things we have to begin with is understand that in traditional ways of responding, mm-hmm. we would be trying to control that child's behavior.
Absolutely.
And giving that child feedback that somehow something's wrong with them.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So the first question really is, how do we change the people who are interacting with his ways of thinking about that child? Mm-hmm. That's first thing.
Yeah.
Second thing is, how do we change the child's thinking about themselves? Mm. Right? Then we're going to kind of also have to change the environment, which means that the individual teacher in that class doesn't have the resources available to meet that child's needs. Not that there's something wrong with the teacher or there's something wrong with the child, but there's a resource issue.
Yeah.
So that the teacher has to collaboratively work with the other adults in the school to figure out maybe this child can only engage in cognitive kinds of activities for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then that child needs to have somebody outside walk them around and move and do it, right? So we're going to slowly help that child learn how to tolerate different states. Instead of, you need to come to the state that everybody else is in the class. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
So I think it starts with a group of people getting together and saying, how do we understand this behavior? And what does this child need? So it's the same way thinking about it is, this child has adapted to having an extremely high, level of heart rate, right? Mm-hmm. The opposite could be true, that somebody's adapted to having a really low level of heart rate and they're shut down.
Yeah.
And to ask that person to engage in the classroom is going to create the same type of perceived stress and threat to that child that we think when we shut down or we get disconnected. So we have to first understand and create a model of understanding of the child to create the interventions instead of trying to just manage their behavior.
Yeah.
And that's the easy answer, hard to do though.
Absolutely. Kurt, I wonder your thoughts on what Jerry, because Jerry's talking about thinking and all this stuff. Well, from the behavioral perspective, I'd love to get your kind of, thoughts on this as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think as I was listening, I think that my thoughts are that being able to think about the child's symptoms and what the child's experience may be is important to the context of intervention. So when you're talking to people who are trained in a behavioral approach, context is an important word. Mm-hmm. Right, so understanding how teams are thinking about and interpreting the symptoms is part of the context of intervention. So for me, it's really important to find that out. Almost like that ought to be part of a functional behavior assessment, is how is the team thinking about these symptoms? Yep. And I'm sure like a well-trained clinician would do that. But I think that, it may be that even the interventions that you may put in place if you only considered proximal events to the symptom, right? Which would be kind of in that category of what we call just managing behavior.
Yeah.
It may be the interventions that you do, but you want to consider how, if you did those interventions, could they be creating some kind of reenactment of what the child's experience has been previously?
Great.
One of the easy ways to create traumatic reenactments is with an intervention that I often hear a lot, which is planned ignoring. Mm-hmm. That's a really tough one to do well. And the likelihood that it's going to result in some kind of reenactment of what a child has experienced to generate these extreme coping strategies is really high. Mm-hmm. So being thoughtful about those, I mean, it may be that that's what you do, but having the discussion, as Jerry said, of how do we understand this and picking interventions and being able to answer the question, why would that work? Mm-hmm. Like what is our understanding that would drive us picking this intervention is a really important process to go through. So I think that how people think about things is part of the context of intervention and can't be underscored how important that is.
Awesome. So I have another question, but I don't want to keep hogging the question asking, but so feel free to jump in. I want to take this because to me, the environment and relationships being a part of that, I often struggle with this, and I think the classroom setting's, you know, great. I think with children, we can see it from a big piece. But let's take these two questions. Let me ask it from a different point of view. Let me ask it about maybe somebody in their mid-40s or 50s who've experienced chronic homelessness. And a lot of times, I think societal-wise, we look at that person all wrong because we just think they're lazy. But for those of us that are in the field, we know there's a lot more going on there. So if we say with the answer, the first question is history of sexual abuse, domestic violence, probably some addiction in there. And so we've been good with the first question, and we've asked why, and we get some understanding of the complexity of the cases with this, probably starting out as that behavioral issue early on in school and having those troubles. When you think about the second question and sort of, okay, what we look at an environment, what expectations, if we have somebody that's living out on the street or living in even a domestic violence situation, those sort of traumatic situations, as we talked about the small T trauma or big T or a combination of both, when we look at that individual who has this complex history into adulthood, what do you think, help me with the first and second questions. We understand them, so we may get the first question. How do we look at and conceptualize what that person needs to sort of get out of that, get into permanent housing, maybe get back into the workplace? How would you sort of use these two questions to set up thinking on that sort of a case?
You know, Matt, I'm struck by when we talk about the child in the classroom, mm-hmm. or we talk about the adult you just described, everybody outside is trying to get that person to do something.
Yeah.
Who in their life is just trying to be with that person and understand that person? To really see the world from their perspective, to really in some ways say is, I'm more interested in making a connection than I am about changing you. I think if we really want to make change in people, that's where change takes place. And it doesn't mean that the teacher is the one to do that, but if we don't have somebody in our lives who is just there to be with us, mm-hmm. it's very, very hard to accomplish what, because I believe when people feel like we're truly connected and there, they're willing to do many things that are painful and hard.
Yeah.
So I wonder about these two examples that the same process has to happen, that somebody has to stop for a moment and say, tell me about your world. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your experience. tell me about how I might help you. And whether that's in, you know, words, but my everything in terms of my body posture, my tone of my voice is I'm here not to change you, but to have a connection with you.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important part of the process that gets missed with these people who create somewhat distress for us. Mm-hmm. That we try to somehow do something to them or do something for them instead of connecting with them.
Yeah.
What a challenge to do that, right? I mean, that our cultural systems are set up to produce that.
You're right.
That if my job to be a clinician, it is to produce change. Mm-hmm. So my drive is if somebody sitting in front of me is, if I don't produce change, it creates discomfort for me. And then I've got to respond to that discomfort in the same way that we're talking about what would drive, why would somebody engage in certain symptoms? I mean, you could certainly conceptualize a part of that drive as a symptom of the system. And that we've got to understand why we do that. Why do I have this drive to help people change? That's, mm-hmm. could certainly have to examine those motivations on a moment-to-moment basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think what I see, and I see, I pay a lot of attention to this from a policy level as well. I mean, there's, I think Wisconsin and my home state of Indiana, you see this, whether it's connected to healthcare, food stamps, or other things. It's like, you know, I think in Wisconsin, they're going to start requiring drug tests in order to get, you know, some assistance. I believe it's food stamps, but it might be other things. In Indiana, if you want healthcare, which I believe is a human right, but you know, that's a different argument for a different day. You've got to be working towards getting a job if you don't have one. And so I think from the you know, the behavioralist perspective is like we get policymakers kind of stepping in who are, you know, again, I would not compare them anyway in what you do, Kurt, to two different worlds in many ways. But I think they're always trying to, the second part of this question is how do we motivate these people through a lot of times what is punishment, old school type of punishment, Old Testament kind of punishment at times it feels like. And you know, it's such a frustrating thing for me as I travel around the country because it never works. And we put, what I also find interesting is I get my housing's government subsidized. The government pays, you know, gives me a big refund check on my mortgage interest every year. I don't have to take a drug screen to get that, you know, and which I pass, by the way, 100%. I meet all Colorado state laws.
Thanks for that way. Clarifying that, right?
Yeah. I'd be okay. Federal, but yeah, it's in the water here. But you know, I think that we look at them and there's something wrong with them. And if we only punish them in a certain way or do something, we change the equation. And I think, Kurt, hearing from you from that behavioral perspective, I think what I'm hearing you say is with this first question, we can't really get there until we have the deeper understanding. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, it really can inform your interventions. And I think one of the unfortunate things that has been, how do I say, like, attributed to what is behavioral and what is not behavioral is that if it's punitive, it must be behavioral. But I know any well-trained behavioral person would never use punishment.
Exactly.
They would always use reinforcement and positive events and rewarding events. And that would always be where we went to. And then it can certainly be, I mean, from a technical standpoint, be shifted to, I mean, I've done so many trainings with caregivers and with parents, and we talk about using positive repetitive experience a lot, and really quickly and almost invariably by the most caring parents, mm-hmm. They very quickly go to, well, if misbehavior happens, then I'm going to take it away.
Yeah.
Right? Because that causes such discomfort for the most caring people. Like the people who are the most caring are the ones who often go to that first because it's so hard for them.
Yeah.
And that is not necessarily behavioral. A behavioral approach is one that tries to look at as many whys as possible mm-hmm. and design the environment so that it supports what is the best for that person.
Yeah.
And that is a blend. Like for me, as soon as I heard that out of my first training, I think in trauma-informed care, was that the fundamental belief is that everybody's doing the best that they can with what they have in the environment that they're in. And I thought, that's a functional behavior assessment right there. Mm-hmm. Like that's what that means.
Yeah.
So it was a match for me quite quickly.
Absolutely. And so let me throw out one more. We're kind of running up against time, but I just kind of, let's put this in a practical context of, so, hey, I just was working with library folks. So let's throw it in there. So somebody comes in and there's a disruptive behavior. Let's say by a teenager, we'll kind of put it between the young child and the adult. So a teenager has a real disruptive behavior that takes a safe environment and makes everybody feel a little shaken in their own self. And maybe security has to get involved. And at least the short-term solution is we've got to remove that person from the environment for the safety of everybody. And from the outside perspective, we'd all probably agree that that's the best thing in the moment. How would is these people, and I think this could transition into so many different environments. So you have a disruptive behavior, whether that's in a homeless shelter, a library, a classroom. So we're sitting there and they just listen to our podcast for this is their first episode. And they, okay, Jerry, Kurt, and Matt said, we've got two questions to do this. How would you have somebody structurally then take a disruptive behavior and sort of implement what we've been talking about today?
So I think one of the things that the first thing is, if you could take a moment to pause, how is this individual's behavior affecting my behavior?
Great.
I want to be intentional about how I respond, not be organized by the person in front of me. So I want to be aware of the tone of my voice. I want to be aware of my facial expressions. I want to be aware of my proximity to the individual in front of me. I want to be intentional about how I respond to this person.
Yeah.
Because what I don't want to do is become a threat cue to the person to elevate this situation.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know a lot about all the whys.
Right.
I'm more concerned with what are the cues in the current environment. Mm-hmm. Using Kurt's language, right? What am I in control of is me.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that the individuals who are dysregulated in some form are going to dysregulate us.
Yeah.
The first intervention is always to self.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, and then when I'm in that spot, I can actually think and plan and execute an effective response to this individual, whether that be calling for security, whether that be,
yeah.
But at least I'm thoughtful about it rather than reactive.
Yeah. And I think a plug, just a quick plug, Kurt, I want to get to you, but for our own self-care as well, because if we're burned out or stressed out, that becomes a really difficult thing to regulate our own self. Kurt, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I often put things into lists and numbers and categories. And when I was listening to Jerry, I thought of one that I had done was years ago when I first started supervising groups of clinicians. And I had to manage my own internal state in that. Because I'm in front of a group and I'm responsible for what this group is doing. And they ask you hard questions. it would make me anxious. And so I had to give myself a three-step process that I could use to think through and help me to think about how am I going to help this group? And it was to pause, to label my internal state, and then to ask a question and make myself go through that every single time, even if it meant there was a little bit of silence in the room. And I thought, you know, that was kind of like, I probably got that from Jerry talking to me one day. But I actually would put it on a piece of paper that I would take with me. And I gave myself 10 questions that I always wanted to be able to ask in the group. And so I think I would echo that advice from Jerry of pause, determine how much time you have to make a decision, see how you're doing, and then start asking questions.
Great. And just to sort of add some of my own thinking around that too is you know, kind of you know, all these strategies helping us just to sort of get out of our emotional response to it, whether it's in the moment or whether it's afterwards. And I think where I know for me that the trauma-informed paradigm and everything that goes with it is there's probably something deeper behind this behavior. I think that's the power of that first question is this is probably somebody who's hurting in some ways. And they may not be able to express that in the moment, or even if they're regulated, they may not be ready to that. And I think, you know, it also just talks to the sophistication of our work is, you know, I think the answer to so many of the first questions is what's behind this is a history of trauma. It is present struggles with big T and small T traumas. And, you know, we're not all mental health therapists, and not everybody that we run across to that has a disruptive event in the library or in the shelter is ready to jump into therapy either. And so as Jerry said, I think is such a critical point to this is who is the person in this individual's life who can connect with them in some meaningful way. And again, in the perfect world, they'd have a case manager, a teacher, a behavioralist, a mental health, you know, we'd have all these people, but for so many of the individuals, they're lucky to have one person in whatever position. And I know a lot of people that listen to this podcast are that one person. And, you know, that can seem overwhelming to us, but just know that there's that power in connecting. And to try to find the time to have that genuine experience with somebody, even if you're not a mental health professional, to me, that's where healing happens. I've come up with this very sophisticated clinical term. Both probably have more education in psychology than I do. I got 3 years of graduate work, but I came up with this term is that the healing starts to happen when somebody gives a shit about us. That's what I got from 3 years of graduate school. Somebody gives a shit. They come in and they care. And they care deeply about us, and they kind of go through the ups and downs of the behavior with us. And whether that person's an outreach worker, a member of our church, a teacher, a coach, somebody comes in and cares enough to kind of go through with that. And I know, you know, a lot of folks listening to this are those people in others' life. And so I think we have to just pay attention to that core thing about that helping and education is such a critical piece of this that we can't forget. So last thoughts. I know we got Jerry's question of the week still to get to. Any other thoughts before we get to that? Great conversation today. All right, Jerry, what kind of question you got for us this week?
So I have a reflective question. So my question is what are those environmental conditions that make it hard for you to stay connected to yourself? So as you're going through the week, if you could stop and be reflective and think, when was it really hard for me to pause, identify my internal state, and ask a question? Right? When we really, what we're trying to change the most to change others is to become more aware of ourselves. So that's the question of the week.
Awesome. Great. Excellent podcast. This was fun.